So, is this good volume? There in the back? Somehow there's a little bit more echo. You're in a large room, and our minds and hearts are spacious. And so the Dhamma will echo throughout our practice today. Again, I appreciate your reflections, Fred, especially around the notion that we keep the Dhamma alive through our practice. And some have dedicated their lives to keeping the Dhamma alive through offering the teachings as an expression of gratitude owing to the immeasurable power of liberation. And I want to say as well, joy that comes as a result of receiving support as one does, as I have throughout my life to practice. And I wanted to add that, are you sure you can hear? I wanted to add that in the reflection that I was enjoying in what Fred was saying, I remembered, and I feel that it's so important to remember, and I forget, and then I remember, that from the very first moment that I stepped upon the path of Dhamma, I was supported. I have never once paid for a retreat or for training or anything else. It came out of a force that exists within our collective consciousness, especially within the Dhamma community. And I realize it in a particular way for myself, as I mentioned it, that I realize it as a karma, and one I wanted to take good care of. And one of the things that I will address in the focus here with equanimity is a really simple understanding of karma. So that when I recognize this karma of this extraordinary support, generosity, I literally have this experience of awe. How could it be that there could be so much support and generosity? You know, it just opened to a whole different perception of a sense of responsibility. And equanimity, again, I'll refer to it, is the very essence of an ability to respond to life. And one of the means through which we respond is the growing capacity for awe. It's like, you know, we have this So nobody ever said this to me, you know, you must this or that or that or this or do this or that. My parents told me I could do anything I wanted to, and I have. I didn't know what they meant by that, but I have received this good fortune. And therefore, naturally, in that sense of awe, realizing the basis or the force of this good fortune in the form of Dhamma. You know, that one time on retreat with one of the sayadaws that I practice with, oh please don't offer Dhamma. Your practice is Dhamma. Now that's just my karma, you know, to hear this and to have it reinforced and to have that sense of the motivation to keep Dhamma alive. Because without it, there is no Dhamma. Without Dhamma, there's no Dhamma. It's the first parami, force of clarification and purification of heart. And this is not about wanting to inspire you to put more money or chickens or whatever. Maybe Fred will put his bottle of scotch. you know, in the basket. This is not to inspire that, but to just say that as we breathe with increasing gratitude, we recognize our own good fortune. And equanimity is the pivoting point, really. Equanimity is like the point of fulcrum of so much that becomes clarified in our lives as we practice inadvertently. Inadvertently. One of my practices having to do with what I'm referring to is that I had the good fortune of being invited to facilitate the opening here of this beautiful, my goodness, beautiful Dhamma Center, your home, after being in your other home that you shared for so many years, the Wat. And so I said that every time I, and so it was a mudita ceremony. And so I committed that every time I approach the door, I stop to honor mudita out of this gratitude for, it was almost like a manifestation of a vision, you know, here. And so I have, with the exception of one time, I did forget, long time ago, since then, one time, I have stopped and honored the mudita factor here. Mudita is the capacity to recognize our good fortune. So, everything about life and living and the clarity with which, by which we experience everything is how we come to recognize the Dhamma. It becomes just naturally mirrored in our capacity to listen, in our capacity to see, our capacity to breathe with life, which is one of the points that I made on Thursday, that our capacity, what we're doing in our practice, is offering our attention. This is generosity. The greatest generosity is to offer our attention to that which will open our sense doors. Offer our attention to moments of recognition that they are not open, that they are closed with a kind of haze of static having to do with some kind of other impulse, you know, other than this intention to open our sensorium. We hear, you know, and we've studied to some degree the Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations of mindfulness, and, you know, we can kind of look at this as a teaching. Here it is, a teaching. Meanwhile, all teachings are really just mirrors of our own personal experience. In the practice, we begin to see the relevance of establishing a foundation based in direct experience. Direct experience is what's occurring here, as opposed to an experience born of imagination or the root cause of suffering, which is craving or clinging or grasping, which is the process that goes on in the mental field when the mental field is still kind of obscured without motivation and intention. So that the mental field is just this kind of static process by which our attention careens back and forth, wanting and not wanting. Have you noticed? It's stunning. And for me, it becomes ever more subtle. I shared on Thursday that just within a day or so, I had had this real clear sense of that movement. You know, it was almost, you know how in the spring when the leaves are very translucent and there are these amazingly beautiful, subtle, soft days where light is just passing through this translucence, And you can, you know, it's like this, you know, it's like a flickering of light. Or if you ever sat on the ocean shore and watched, or a lake, you know, where the light is just playing and it's just happening so quickly. We can't perceive it as anything other than just the movement of light. And I had that experience of the awareness. I started to use the word enlightenment, but I hesitate because I don't want you to think that I mean something that we don't yet understand. You know, but there was that sense of, yes, it's like this, just this wanting, not wanting, and like that. It was like, oh my goodness. That which was in awareness with it was like the sky. Have you ever looked at the sky and realized that we think the sky is the color? We think the sky are the clouds. We think the sky is a lot of different things depending upon what we see in the ever-changing environment of sky. Have you ever had that experience that sky has no definition? It's just space. It's just space with ever-changing conditions that we identify as sky. And these moments where there's some kind of clarity, it doesn't matter what it is. Clarity is like a neutral. Clarity is neutral. It's not about anything. But what it does is it just radiates through the conditioning. It penetrates through conditioning for one to recognize, oh, this is what is generally identified with. This is what the thinking process holds as information having to do with something. And our practice is this radical transition that's happening inadvertently. It's not the I doing anything, but an inclination that arises within individual consciousness that is simply a shift in attention. It's said that the first moment of, you know, well, it's referred to as hearing the Dhamma. That's misleading because it's not relative to any particular sense door. But that sense of something that shifts, and the shifting is known as significant. It's inexplicable, but there's a knowing of something significant. And then from here, when this occurs, if it occurs within this embodiment, there's a quality of receptivity that allows for a reevaluation over time that's informed by the Buddhist teachings and manifested through what we call practices. This inclination inclines itself through its own sensibility to that which is dormant within our human consciousness that we are able, if we choose and when we choose, to cultivate. So this experience that I had of wanting, not wanting, impulse was no longer a concept that had been recognized inadvertently. It was an experience of the impulse, the rapid-fire impulse of the delusion of the conditioning that comes into existence with us, that this is our role, that somehow we're supposed to figure it out through this wanting and not, or not wanting. And some of us over time began to realize how absolutely impermanent that is. I want this. I want this. I don't just want it. I want it with all my heart, with all my will. And now I don't want it anymore. You know, I used to like a certain kind of ice cream. I don't like it anymore. I used to think about it and want it, and it would motivate my body to go down to get this ice cream, and I would use these words, and I'd say, I like this ice cream, please. I used to like licorice ice cream, isn't that weird? And a scoop of licorice and a scoop of lemon custard. My mouth would get all dark and everything. I didn't care, it was delicious. I don't even think about licorice ice cream anymore. I'm surprised I'm remembering. But I really wanted it. I wanted it so much that my mind and body would arrange their interconnectedness in order to navigate through all these different obstacles, all these other attentional possibilities, and to get this ice cream. Have you noticed how this is? You want something? Something comes into a convergence where everything is there to hold the mind still in this fulfillment of the wanting until one experiences it. And then an experience is so fleeting, like the flickering of the light. This is the Dhamma revealing itself. You know, we sometimes think of the Dhamma as a golden Buddha or a particular regalia or belongs to Asia or, you know, but really it's just mirrored right here. And that which allows for it to become more interactive is the offering of our attention in the transition that we make through equanimity from this view that I am going to do this in a transactional way. Fred mentioned in your last Dhamma talk that, you know, rather than it being a transactional is it's a kind of business deal. You know, it's like I'll sign a contract. I will practice. I will, you know, engage the teachings of the Buddhas and Buddha and the practices if I get what I'm investing in here. And so I hear a lot on retreat particularly. I'm not getting from my practice what I want or need. It's like, oh, well, yeah, so we can talk about motivation. As I was driving here, I'm driving in this blue car, this rental car, and speeding along. Oh my gosh, I'm going 80. Everybody's going 80. At home, we go, you know, like 2 miles an hour, but, you know. And suddenly, you know, there was just this arising having to do with the term motivation. And what I really enjoy about these moments of the arising of the Dhamma is that they reflect in a nuanced way, in a manner that is never the same when they arise. And so the term motivation became reflected in the fact that motivation right now is completely integrated into the practice. It's not separate. And that the motivation to practice is to offer attention to that which is wholesome, to that which is possible, to that which is inherent, to that which can otherwise not arise and be recognized and shared. And what I mean by shared, I don't mean as a Dhamma teacher. I don't even think of myself as a Dhamma teacher. That's just a kind of a reference. It's just more that we share what we perceive, whether it be in silence or whether it be in form. We share, and everything that we experience interconnectedly, whether we have this growing sense of the value of belonging to this wonderful Sangha and being in silence, it's like, oh, the value becomes coming and being in silence. It's not what we're getting. It's that we are honoring something that is, essential to our nature, that allows for some degree of stillness so that we find as a result that our attention is more inclined to offering itself to that which is. If we come in and sit down with an agenda, I want this, I want that, I want that, I want this, then we're in our conventional relationship with wanting, clinging, and craving. So motivation arose with this sense, you know, and certain information reflecting into it that, yeah, motivation in life born and maintained through intention with a clear sense of owning one's own attention. Ownership in this sense of is equanimity, owning one's attention. I don't own anything other than my attention. And this is pointed out, that everything is just a process that's occurring within itself. Whereas we as human beings, it's said, I'll translate, are supreme. Did I say this the other night? You might not have been here. But anyway, supreme, and supreme means all these kind of big words, means that we have great responsibility. Supreme, it's a responsibility. In our own nature, we are capable. I'm not talking about going out, what am I going to be responsible for? It's about reestablishing one's attentional factor aligned with intention, so they're in balance, so that life is born of an increasing awareness of what's called bhavana or cultivation. We begin to recognize the distinction between the conditioned view and all of its impulses. Actually, it's not over here, it's right here. And intention. And it's a different view. It's not a narcissistic view. How do I look? You know, how does this augment how I want to be seen? It's a neutral positive that has to do with growing integrity. Integrity is an interesting word for me because I take it out of the moral relevance into what's called sila, integrity, where that which is dispersed and that which is fragmented is integrated into an environment of increasing expansiveness and tolerance for some stillness. And for instance, tolerance for stillness is just that wonderful inclination that we experience suddenly to pause. To pause in the middle with some action. We don't need to know what it is, it's just pausing. A moment of stillness. And in fact, we hear about the middle path. We are beginning to recognize and honor the indicators of path, and that inclination sometimes just to pause for the sake of pausing is an indicator of a tolerance for increasing stillness. So that equanimity that exists within this stillness is able to discern. And discernment is not a thinking process. It's an automatic knowing of the distinction between that which is wholesome and that which is not. And it begins to operate spontaneously. And you may have experienced pausing. There's something that just calls to stillness. And something arises, let's say, through speech or through thought that is not what one would have said, what one would have thought. It's of a different order. Have you ever been in a conversation with someone, la 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 la, and then this energy arises in conveyance that then is bypassed by something else that one would intend? And this is discernment. It's not the I in observation. You know, I'm, you know, watching this to make sure I. It's discernment. Discernment, by its nature, is able to detect, for instance, vedana, sensation. One of the first discernments that arises within our practice, owing to this distilling aspect of equanimity, some tolerance for stillness, is just to be able to detect the distinction between what's called nama, or thinking. Nama is mentality, and arupa, which is physicality. We can be practicing, thinking we're practicing, I'm practicing, I like this practice, I don't like this practice. I wish, you know, that I could practice more, I don't practice enough, I wish, you know, I want, okay, that's right, breathing, I'm going to breathe. We can practice for eons without any discernment having to do with the distinction between nama and rupa. This is why I like to bring it up, because of the fact that this is usually something that's discerned when there is some degree of concentration. But in my personal experience, with the understanding that the Dhamma is, it just is, there is the capacity to recognize the distinction between thinking and the intention, alignment, attention with sensation within breathing. Now, of course, it doesn't happen very often. It's just an invitation. It's just an invitation with the acknowledgement that this is what's possible. But why would I want to just sit and be aware of breathing? There's so much to think about. Really, you know, I have to think about my son because he said this, and what am I going to do? And I have to think about that. And as I become, you know, a little bit settled, I think about things that are really important. Oh, yes, here's breathing. Okay, it's breathing. Now I can think more clearly. Right? And as our practice matures, there's a greater noticing inclination within that which is a non-thinking awareness. And the awareness of vedana, or sensation within breathing, is a non-thinking awareness. Try it out. If it's linked to thinking, then it's still in the umbilical relationship with the, you know, the womb of possibility. You know, I have to think. You know, it's like, well, all right, even if there's thinking. No thinking, right? Knowing, noting, noticing, and just kind of hone in with sensation. Because sensation is perpetual and can only be known as sensation. Does that make sense? Breathing can only be known through sensation. Sensation within breathing is perpetual, and it can only be known as sensation. The only duality that can be registered within breathing is pleasant or unpleasant. Beyond that, it's called papancha. It's associative. And we begin to have that sense of awe, all of thinking, wanting and not wanting, the whole shebang, you know, the whole samsaric process is a mistake in experience based in sensation. Pleasant sensation, oh my gosh, pleasant sensation, brrr, into the dream. Oh, I had a pleasant sensation, it's going to happen. What's going to happen? What do I want? What do you want? I don't know, let me check my dream. You know, let's see, my dream has changed. What do I want? Oh, okay, I don't want to be married. I want to find somebody that... I don't think marriage is really what I want. What I want to do is just find somebody who... And we're going to live in separate houses and have a modern... Oh, wait a minute, hold on. Oh, I want a ham sandwich. I was in retreat one time, and I'm not a vegetarian any longer, but I was... And I was about a couple weeks into this retreat, and I got obsessed with a ham sandwich. I could taste it. I could, you know, I was like conjuring at this kind of mustard, that kind of mustard, this kind of bread. And until the trance broke and I realized what this was a consolidation of wanting. I was able to note wanting. The dream was happening, pleasant sensation, a ham sandwich, that's what I want. It like became so absolutely ridiculous. I don't eat ham. It's not within my intentional range. And that's what tricked the mind into being awake. This was just wanting. Most of the time, the wanting doesn't really want what it thinks it wants. It's kind of a metaphor for something, because it becomes something else as soon as we have it. It becomes like everything else, an ever-changing range of pleasant and unpleasant sensations that are related to all these different mind states. Unpleasant sensation arises. Uh-oh. Unpleasant sensation. Uh-oh. Everything bad about me and the world, everything that's wrong, everything, it's called hell. I was once reading a book a long time ago. I didn't finish the book, but the line that jumped out of the book, which was enough, you know, I closed it and put it away, was this scenario where somebody, I'll say his name is Arnold, walks in and asks somebody else, where is Joseph? And the response is, oh, he's gone to hell to find Julie. And that's what we do. We go to hell to find the self. I want to find myself. I want to know myself. I want self, self, self. And then with equanimity, in this distilling potential that happens in a momentary sense, we recognize that self is just an impulse. A painful one, by the way. Because remember Pac-Man? It's like, you know, it's just, it's the manifestation of craving. Equanimity wants just kind of open to reveal that, yeah, it makes sense. You know, that self is born of craving because two craving beings come together and create another craving being. And bless this craving being with the possibility of having the good fortune of hearing the Dhamma. So this cycle of craving that I have the good fortune to be born with can be recognized for what it is. And to realize that every moment within itself is complete, is fulfilled. As we begin to honor certain aspects of our consciousness that help us to make sense out of our experience of pleasant and unpleasant. Just this. Begins to sound kind of Taoist and esoteric. Isness. And yet, since everything is a life form, and every sound and every motion or movement within is a life form, when we form that sense of is, then it turns into an enveloping return to what is. What is in this moment? Well, the only reliable isness is breathing. Think about it for a moment. No. My most reliable thing in the world is my husband. Oh, no, the most reliable thing in the world is, I don't know, is what? What is your dream? of something that is ever-changing that you think is utterly reliable, other than breathing? The beauty of equanimity is that it is very much aligned with the factors that allow for the support of this very simple clarifying view of what is and what is occurring and how to view it and how to respond to it. And this is informed through Dhamma. It's not, we can't dream it. You know, it's there, it's all within the teachings and applicable practices. And one is informed by a colloquial view of upeka. Upeka is translated as equanimity. In India, a colloquial view of it is viewing with patience. And so that's really where we're going to be and continue to be in our practice today, is understanding that when there is enough stillness to be able to call upon intention in a way that isn't trying to fulfill anything, but just allows for the equanimity of what it is that is and to be with that which is, then the attentional factor settles more and more into breathing. Because breathing is life. Now, if we're thinking, we can't make sense out of this. But through our own experiential process, as we begin to view with patience within this process of life that's unfolding in each moment of existence, there is an inclination for our attention to rest here in a receptivity, and that receptivity is referred to as mindful awareness. There is no mindfulness without this transition from wanting to offering our attention in a way that opens to what is. There's lots of fancy words for it, but sati or mindfulness is reliant upon upeka, equanimity, for the stillness that exists in any given moment that allows for this receptivity to that which is rather than that which is wanted or not wanted. This is our training. This is not a friendly word, training. But I bring it up. We're over the 60s. You know, we can use words like discipline and training. Are we over the 60s? Let me see. 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Have 50 years been enough, you know, to get over? You know, that what we're really doing is training our own attention. Like, in a loving way, like we do with a child. Like we say to our child, come here. It's time to eat. Sit here. Allow for yourself to receive. Come here. Open to the possibility of just being with this, which is. It's time to be nourished by entering into the receptivity, mindful awareness with that which is, with life. Come here. I'm noticing that you're breathing. Do you notice my breathing? I'm being a mother. I can't help it. I have a bunch of children. You know, I notice your breathing. Do you notice mine? Do you notice yours? You notice yours, I'll notice mine. Isn't this interesting? This is one possibility. So enough about equanimity in a way that really distills it within the possibility of what we refer to as our practice. It is said that our practice in Dhammapada, the teachings, and of course teachings are related to practices. This is Buddhism, not an ideological, but a practice or an approach. And so the teachings, the practices are simple. And within that simplicity, there's a possibility for this freedom from suffering. And within this, just keep remembering patience. Patience. Because there is no beginning. There is no end. Other than the capacity, with understanding the metaphor with upeka, equanimity, to be here in the middleness with that which is. Do you have any questions about the day or about the suggestions that you've heard? Because I'm not teaching anything. I'm just reflecting in a way where you're recognizing within the mirror of your own practice what makes sense and that which you intend to cultivate. Any questions? Yeah, oh, sorry, there's light behind you. Yeah. Right. I wondered about that when I woke up this morning.
I didn't wonder about that soon.
The who what?
I didn't wonder about that soon.
What's that word?
Soon?
I didn't get...
I should wonder about the schedule, but not right away.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. The schedule is going to be basically traditional, you know, 45 minutes of sitting, half an hour of walking, adapted a little bit to fit into the fact that we'll be having our lunch at 12:30, and then we begin again at 1:30 using lunch as a practice time, personal, and with the same, I'll offer some reflections, and then we'll enter into practice. So, you know, we don't have it listed. We can look at that possibility in the future, but we don't have it listed. But because you're here, and everything's gonna be just bells, you can just remember, you know, what your intention is, and you're either gonna be sitting or walking. But I think it would be good to have a schedule posted for the future. I don't know. An intention? Any other questions? Okay. So within this 5-minute period before the bell rings for a walking period, just allow for the fact that Dhamma reflection or conveyance is referred to as a nutrient, desana nutrient. Allow the food to feed the intention of how you intend to use this opportunity you've given yourself today. And enter into your practice, like stepping into the stream. The mental field of thinking is vast, infinite forms having to do with past and future. When thinking has absorbed your attention, just note thinking and return to intention. See how your attention just comes into balance with, as an example, the process of breathing, a non-thinking awareness, the sensations. Sensations are sensations. Thinking is thinking. Returning. This is a half an hour walking period. The bell will ring in 25 minutes to invite us back into our sitting practice.